Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You're on ABC Radio National. I'm Robin Williams. I'm here to introduce the pinnacle of the Big Ideas year, the annual Boyer Lectures. The 48th Boyer Lecturer is Professor Graham Clark. You'll probably know him as the Bionic Ear Man. Professor Clark led the development of the world's first cochlear implant. Now inspired by his example, scientists are working on a bionic eye, and something that seems barely credible, the possibility of a bionic spinal cord. Imagine what that could bring to thousands rendered immobile or wheelchair-bound. It's a neurological revolution in progress, begun in Melbourne. But learning to move again, like learning to hear with an implant, won't be the same as it was when we grew up. It'll be a different world of sensation. And that's what today's program is about. Dr. Graham Clark is founder and director of the Bionic Ear Institute and professor at the University of Wollongong. Let's join him now for the second of his 2007 Boyer Lectures.
In the last lecture, we learned just how magnificent the senses of hearing, vision, touch and movement are, our only contact with the world around us. If we lose one or more of these senses, the effects can be devastating. Even so, our brains are very flexible. Helen Keller, who became blind and deaf early in life, was able to learn language through her sense of touch. She remarked, "We the blind are as much indebted to Louis Braille as mankind is to Gutenberg." Even the sense of pain is important. Paul Brand, the pioneering leprosy surgeon, described it as the gift that nobody wants. People with leprosy lose limbs because they don't feel pain, ignore injuries, and as a result, develop deep contact ulcers from pressure and burns. The ability to smell and touch with the lips has taken on an extra value for the leprosy sufferer who wrote this haiku poem. "My hands are numb and broken. I am blind, and I can neither feel nor see my little pot of violets, so I bend to kiss the wee sweet flowers that mean so much to me." If our sensory receptors don't function, then it is possible to develop bionic systems that can detect the physical stimuli and electrically stimulate the central brain pathways in an attempt to copy the normal patterns of excitation. Electrical stimulation is required because the brain and nerve pathways function by generating and transmitting small voltages to other brain cells. What is it like to lose our hearing and become deaf? This possibility does not seem to worry our young people who listen to music at levels which are damaging to the inner ear. Their hearing is usually acute over the frequencies from 20 hertz to 20,000 hertz, a modest range, of course, compared to dogs, which can hear up to 40,000 hertz, and cats to 60,000 hertz. But just as we lose brain cells after the age of 30, so too we lose hearing, and adults will normally have a range up to only 10,000 hertz. This could be reduced to 5,000 hertz or lower if they listen to loud music when young. Recent research has shown that the use of personal stereo headsets is associated with rapid aging of the inner ear, comparable to that with industrial noise trauma. When the sense of hearing is seriously impaired or absent, a person is deaf and will have a marked disability in communicating. Hearing loss is measured by the intensities of sound frequencies that can be heard. The loss can then be classified as mild, moderate, severe, and profound. Any condition, such as excessive wax in the ear, that impedes the passage of sound along the ear canal and through the middle ear, will produce a conductive hearing loss. Any outside influence, such as excessive noise or a virus, that causes damage to the sense organ of hearing in the inner ear or to the hearing nerve, will lead to a sensory or neural hearing loss, commonly referred to as nerve deafness. A conductive loss is more easily corrected. Although the sounds are soft, they are not distorted, and so surgery or hearing aid can amplify the speech to give a good result. But when someone has a sensory deafness, however, they lose many of the sensory cells in the inner ear and auditory nerve fibres. The high frequencies are most often lost, and as they convey much of the intelligibility, communication becomes very difficult. Speech sounds are also distorted, even when amplified with an aid. When most of the sensory cells are absent, no amount of amplification with a hearing aid will help the person hear speech, as there are no sensory cells to stimulate the remaining hearing nerves leading to the brain centres. At best, they will hear muffled sounds. These people were the first who stood to benefit from the bionic ear. Let me now demonstrate to you what it is like to be deaf. You will hear Jonathan Swift's poem on his own deafness, read through filters that remove the high frequencies. The poem reads, "Deaf, giddy, helpless, left alone, to all my friends a burden grown. No more I hear my church's bell than if it rang out for my knell." For someone with normal hearing, it is difficult to realise what it is like to have a hearing loss. Our first bionic ear patient, Rod Saunders, who was profoundly deaf, described it like this. "It is a nightmare being deaf. I would just like to hear voices or the dogs barking. Continual silence is like a prison." Or Jack Day, a bionic ear patient from Washington, who later wrote me a letter in 1990 after his operation and said, "Dear Dr. Clark, I am writing this letter to personally thank you for your development of the cochlear implant. It has truly been a blessing in my life. I lost my hearing due to juvenile rheumatoid arthritis several years ago. My arthritis has affected my entire body with crippling effects in my hands and limbs. I have had both hip and knee replacements and numerous other surgeries. I have lost the sight of one eye and have had a valve replaced in my heart. I have not been able to work and have had to curtail to some extent my travelling, which I dearly love. None of this has bothered me as much or so devastated me as did my hearing loss. I completely withdrew from everything, and I felt totally isolated and left out of everything. If not for the love, care and comfort of my wife and family, I would have been truly lost. Your implant and the work of Dr. Skinner and the Washington University team has given me back my life. I never believed I would be able to hear anything again, but to hear not only sounds and voices again, and to carry on a normal conversation with my wife, is truly a miracle. The voices I hear are not mechanical like sounds, but truly human voices, as I once remember them. I do hear and understand people once again. I wish that I could personally thank you for your work, but Marg, who has been so wonderful to me over the years, has kindly offered to hand-deliver this to you. I am most appreciative of your work and thank you from the bottom of my heart. May God bless you. Sincerely, Jack Day." Children who are born with a severe to profound hearing loss experience all the same problems as adults, and they can become frustrated in their teenage and early adult life, owing to their desire to feel accepted. If deafness begins before language develops, the children have difficulty with receptive and spoken language, and joining in the give and take of conversation. Inevitably, they are disadvantaged educationally, emotionally, and socially. Early diagnosis and treatment are therefore extremely important. I will now play you samples of the speech of a child with severe to profound hearing loss who had AIDS fitted at 5 years. This will give you some idea of the difficulty deaf children have in communicating and the importance of early diagnosis and treatment.
I have
The child was saying, the school pledge at the time, I love God and my country. I honour the flag. I will serve the Queen and cheerfully obey my parents, teachers and the law. There are many more severely and profoundly deaf people in our community than you would realise. Studies in South Australia, in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales and in the United Kingdom reveal that 3 in every 1,000 people are profoundly hearing impaired in both ears. Most of these people will not receive adequate help with a hearing aid and therefore could benefit from the bionic ear. That means that in Australia there are approximately 60,000 profoundly deaf people needing a bionic ear. In addition, 8 in every 1,000 people are severely deaf in the better ear but profoundly deaf in the poorer ear. Many of these people could now benefit from a bionic ear in the poorer ear and a hearing aid in the better one. In Australia, there are some 160,000 people in this category. Furthermore, as shown in a study in Sweden, the severity of the hearing loss increases dramatically with age. As there is an ageing population in Australia, there will be an increase in the number of deaf people in 40 years' time needing a bionic ear. At the moment, approximately 1 in 10 of the population are aged 65 years and over. And in 40 years' time, 1 in 4 will be over 65. These statistics have important implications for the costs of delivering health care. The incidence of deafness in children has remained constant in recent times, especially since Australian doctors Norman Gregg and Douglas Carruthers discovered that if a mother contracted rubella in the first trimester of pregnancy, the fetus could develop visual and auditory disabilities. Thanks to immunisation and other measures, an increase in the incidence of deafness caused by rubella has been prevented. Still, over 1 in 1,000 children are born with deafness due to maternal and genetic factors, approximately 300 new cases each year. In fact, in the year 2000, Australian Hearing Services reported over 500 children under 6 years were fitted with hearing aids for the first time. For the last 200 years, there has been a debate on how best to educate such children. Before this, deaf children were also considered dumb and were treated in a paternalistic way by restricting their freedom to protect them from sexual and other predators. The idea of helping deaf children communicate through the use of signs was the inspiration of L'Abbé de la Paix from the Paris Deaf School, who in 1775 was motivated to help children to relate to each other and to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sign language of the deaf was taken up in the United States by Dr. Thomas Gallaudet, who also had a strong Christian commitment. In addition, he established a college for deaf people now known as the Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. Sign language of the deaf is a system of gestures, body language, facial expressions and fingerspelling with its own language structure. The signs represent thoughts, just as sounds do for English, French and other languages. But deaf people do not have a tiny voice that is part of their thought processes, as do normal hearing people. Interestingly, few deaf people use sign language in their dreams. In Australia, the system is called Auslan. It has done much to help profoundly deaf people. But the disadvantage of communicating with those who have not been able to learn the language remains. As a result, it is harder for children using sign language to compete and to obtain jobs in a community that is essentially geared to those who can hear and speak the language of their wider community. Also, their knowledge of the workplace was found in a study to be very poor. Another method is oral education, which was introduced by Samuel Heinecke in Germany at approximately the same time as sign language of the deaf was developed in France. Heinecke believed that learning to read speech from the lips was a better option, and he became the founder of deaf-dumb education in Germany. Now that some hearing is possible with powerful modern hearing aids, it is combined with training in lip reading and developing listening skills. Skill in reading what is said on the lips or oral education leads to children learning to read much more quickly than expected for those taught with sign language. It is also an advantage if profoundly deaf children born to signing parents are taught English as their first language rather than sign language. Auslan skills do not directly transfer to writing, as shown by one educationalist at the University of Melbourne. The possibility of helping deaf people to hear arose in the first two decades of the 20th century through advances in technology, which made it possible to amplify sound with a hearing aid. The first were wearable carbon hearing aids invented by James Wilson in Alabama and became available in 1902. Sound vibrations caused carbon particles in the microphone to move closer and further apart, varying the passage of electrical current and magnetic field and causing the earphone to vibrate. Carbon hearing aids were not powerful, and few had them, but one was given to the Prime Minister Billy Hughes. About the size of a car battery, it was placed on the table for cabinet meetings. Radio valves made the hearing aids of the 1930s more powerful, but the batteries were still large, so in some cases they were worn strapped to the leg. Then in 1947 the transistor was invented, which allowed a reduction in the battery size so that the hearing aid could be mounted on the head. With the advent of the silicon chip, it became possible to make hearing aids smaller and smarter, and to have the aid manipulate speech sounds to suit the patient's hearing problems. The first attempt to induce hearing with electrical stimuli, as distinct from amplifying sound with an aid, was made in 1800 by Count Alessandro Volta. He inserted a metal rod into each of his ears and connected them to a battery he had developed. He received a jolt to the head and heard a bubbling or crackling sound. Perhaps understandably, this experience deterred others from electrically stimulating the ear for the next 50 years. The development of the radio valve, however, which allowed accurate control of amplification, rekindled interest in producing hearing by electrically stimulating the hearing nerve. This need arose because the developments in hearing aid technology had not succeeded in helping severely and profoundly deaf people adequately. The first attempt to relieve sensory neural deafness with electrical stimulation of the auditory nerve was performed by two Frenchmen, the bioengineer André Journaud and surgeon Charles Ayres. It was not planned, but it took place in 1957 when Eyries was operating on a patient who had lost all hearing after surgery for ear disease. Eyries' main aim was to repair a damaged facial nerve. During the surgery, an anatomist was present, and out of curiosity he asked why they didn't electrically stimulate the auditory nerve. The surgeon found the stump of the nerve, but it was completely shredded. Nevertheless, when it was stimulated, the person could discriminate changes in intensity quite well, and even had a limited ability to detect changes in rate of stimulation. But they could not get him to understand speech. This inspired an attempt with a second deaf person, but without success. No further implants were performed, as it appeared that electric stimulation of the auditory nerve could not reproduce the high frequencies or the discrimination of small changes in rate necessary for speech comprehension. In January 1961, William House, an ear surgeon in Los Angeles, was approached by a profoundly deaf person, asking to have his auditory nerve stimulated after he had read a newspaper report of the work of Duno and Eyries. House implanted a single electrode into this man's inner ear in the hope of using variations in speech amplitudes and frequencies to convey speech intelligibility. But although there were hearing sensations, speech could not be produced for him or for others. Later, in 1964 and 1965 in the United States, neurosurgeon John Doyle and electronic engineer James Doyle, followed by ear surgeon Blair Simmons and his colleagues, tried using multiple electrode wires in a group of deaf people in an attempt to present individual speech frequencies according to frequency place coding in the inner ear or brain. But this was without success. As speech understanding did not occur, Simmons did not attempt further implantations on people for at least another 10 years. He rated the chances of electrical stimulation of the auditory nerve providing uniquely useful communication at only about 5%. Therefore, in 1967, his research led him to think that attempting to stimulate the touch receptors in the skin with patterns representing speech, especially in children, would more likely prove useful. Yet, it was the publication by Blair Simmons of his initial findings that gave me the impetus in 1967 to initiate basic physiological studies to examine the brain cell responses to electrical stimulation in animals. This was to see whether it was possible to reproduce the way the brain coded sound in order to give profoundly deaf people hearing and speech understanding. I will discuss this journey in the next lecture. Turning now to loss of vision, a person may be totally blind and have no light perception. More are legally blind and have some vision, but they can only read at 6 meters what a normally sighted person can read at 600 meters. It is estimated that 4 in 1,000 people in the United States are legally blind, a similar incidence to those who are profoundly deaf. Blindness may be caused by conditions that affect the sensory cells in the retina or the central brain pathways. Common causes are macular degeneration and diabetes. There are 50,000 Australians who are blind. The cost of visual impairment is $5 billion per year. An interview with President of Vision Australia, David Blythe, who has been totally blind since he was 15 years of age, provides insight into how blindness affects a person in their daily life. David has adjusted well. He has learned to use his hearing and other senses and uses a stick for mobility. He says, "When I'm walking down the street, people often say to me, 'You didn't stop before you crossed that side street.' I didn't need to, as I was listening many paces before I got there. If I heard a car, I would stop. Otherwise, I would keep walking. I can also use the feel of the footpath to tell me where I am, and my sense of smell to locate the bakery or restaurant. Loss of the sense of touch, as well as mobility, occurs all too frequently with spinal cord injuries. It is most common in young, healthy males, caused by road accidents, falls and sporting injuries. Approximately 12,000 people in Australia are affected, with at least 300 new cases per year. The cost to the country is roughly $1 million over the lifetime of each individual, thus equating to a total of $12 billion. If the injury affects the neck, then movement of the arms and legs is impaired, and the person becomes quadriplegic, as happened to Christopher Reeve. If the injury is lower, however, then only the person's legs may be affected. They become paraplegic and can move themselves around in a wheelchair. An injury to the spinal cord also has a profound effect on sensation below the site of injury, as well as how the bladder, bowel and sexual organs function. When asked, injured people will often say they would rather have their sensation and sexual function returned, even more than the ability to walk. One of the most critical movements is that of the thumb, so that the pincer action of the hand can be used to pick up objects and feed oneself. To appreciate what it is like to have a spinal cord injury, here is Gary Allsop, Honorary Director of Spinal Cure Australia, who had this to say after being crunched on a football field. There are such things as pressure areas, whereby if you sit for too long in your chair, areas can develop that can be quite dangerous to your health, and quite often put you in bed for long periods of time until they heal. There are also many and varied complications that can arise from living with a body that is paralysed. Add to this the loss of sexual function, marriage breakup, not able to do the job I once did, or live in the house I put so much work into, not to mention the loss of self-esteem, confidence and self-dignity. Then I think it paints a fairly bleak picture of the losses suffered by anyone who out of the blue receives a spinal cord injury. They all have their own personal story. In this lecture, I have emphasised how difficult it is for someone to lose one of their important senses. The possibility now exists to help restore these senses using medical bionics, which uses technology to reconnect the body. It can only be done very imperfectly, but was successfully achieved with the restoration of hearing with a bionic ear. In the next lecture, I will discuss how the research to develop a bionic ear evolved and what lessons can be learned for future discoveries.
Some astonishing possibilities. Professor Graham Clark with the second of his Boyer Lectures. He's founder and director of the Bionic Ear Institute and professor at the University of Wollongong. You're with Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. I'm Robin Williams and it's great to have you with us. And we continue the science theme. Over the next 5 weeks, as companion pieces to the Boyer Lectures, we'll meet some people dedicated to science who we've talked to in the programme In Conversation on ABC Radio National. Last time it was the famous, even notorious, Nobel laureate James Watson, an American who made his name in Britain. This time it's a Scot who spent decades in America, Professor Gillies McKenna, about to move to Oxford and run the biggest outfit in the world, investigating radiation medicine. Of course, most of us imagined that that field was more or less complete, led by the British. Not so?
You're quite right. I mean, there was a time, probably 50 years ago, when Britain was the best place in the world to study radiation biology, and many of the most important discoveries in the field were made here. But what happened over time was that many of those people retired or died or moved to the United States, and they were never replaced. And so the field went from being the premier place to do research in the world to having almost no one left. I mean, they were just waiting for somebody to put the lights out and go home, basically. And somehow they came to the realization that this was actually a very bad thing, because radiation biology I mean, first of all, it underpins all of radiation oncology, the use of radiation to treat cancer. And radiation is the second most common method of treating cancer after surgery, and more than half of all patients will get radiation as part of their course of cancer treatment. So it's not exactly a minor discipline, and there was no one, or practically no one, left to train any of the junior clinicians and scientists, you know, working in this area. And secondly, of course, radiation underlies a lot of cancer risk, and indeed, in the modern era, radiation terrorism is a thing that many people are afraid of. So you do need to have people that understand the biology of how radiation interacts with living tissue.
And I suppose the standard in places like America is far better, and indeed Australia.
Yes, it is. Largely in both America and in Australia because of expatriate Brits that went there and raised, you know, the standards in those countries to very high levels.
Tell me the paradox of the reaction of the body. Of course, you sometimes get this where one element is there for both good and harm. How is it that you can have radiation causing cancer and yet also being able to treat cancer?
Basically because, I mean, radiation works at a number of levels in the body, but we think that the primary target of radiation is the DNA, is the genetic material in the cell. And if you damage the DNA at low levels, it can cause mutations, it can cause changes in genes, and some of those genetic changes can go on and lead to cancer. If you cause sufficient damage to the DNA, the cell will actually die. And so the trick in treating cancer is to cause sufficient damage that the tumor dies and leaves the body, and to try and use the minimum amount of radiation elsewhere in the body so that you're not actually triggering cancers at the same time. So most of the work on triggering cancer with radiation is caused by relatively low doses of radiation where the cells, where people survive them, but the genetic changes go on to cause malignancy. When we use radiation to treat cancer, we're using very high doses, and our goal is for the cell to die, is for the cancer cell to die, and to have none of it left behind in the body so that the patient goes on to be cured.
Now, there were two old sayings, both of them contradictory, of course, that I remember. One of them way back, people saying, actually people in Cambridge saying that there is no lowest limit that is safe. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, people saying that it's everywhere, especially if you've got granite and or Brazil nuts or something, and that a certain minimum level is kind of good for you.
That still remains a very controversial area to this day. In terms of the practicalities of how you deal with sort of artificial sources of radiation that you introduce into the environment, from x-rays in hospitals to nuclear power stations. I mean, we take the attitude that we should reduce that amount of radiation to as low as is reasonably achievable. But it's also true that that radiation is perfectly natural. It occurs in nature. Many rocks and processes are radioactive. There are many parts of the world that have very high levels of radioactivity. And indeed, there is some data that would suggest that populations that live in those places are animals that are exposed to very low levels of radiation, in some cases may benefit from it. It's probably because, I mean, since we've evolved in a radioactive environment, I mean, we're constantly being bombarded by radiation, both from the rocks that we live on and from the sun and from outer space, we've developed very good ways of repairing the damage that DNA causes. I mean, we are all creatures on this planet have evolved to deal with radiation damage. We have mechanisms for repairing it. And in fact, that's one of the difficulties when you come and try and use radiation to treat cancer, is that the body is so damn good at repairing the damage that radiation causes. And you have to overwhelm, you know, that ability to repair radiation damage before you can cause the cancer cell to die.
And presumably have finely focused radiation.
We do. I mean, when I first went into radiation oncology back in the very early 1980s. I remember a very senior oncologist in the United States saying to me at that time, why are you doing this? Within 5 years, we won't be using radiation to treat cancer. And of course, he was exactly wrong. The use of radiation, in fact, has grown enormously since the early 1980s. And one reason for that is that the technology has so improved. We can very, very precisely deposit radiation dose within tumors. And because of advances like MRI scanning and CT scanning and PET scanning, we can very accurately define where the tumor is. So in fact, radiation oncology is a field that has been driven by these incredible advances in imaging and in radiation deposition in the last, 10 or 20 years, and has grown to be even more important in the treatment of cancer, not less.
So I suppose the old images of people being really harrowed by their radiation treatment are not exactly a thing of the past, but far, far less common.
Oh, far less common. I mean, it's still a fear that we deal with to this day. I mean, every family that you meet and you tell them that someone may need a course of radiation, I always remember some great aunt that had terrible radiation burns from her radiation treatment in the past. But really, that is a thing of the past. I mean, radiation is not without side effects, and we still have them, and we still have to deal with them. But we no longer have the tremendous reactions and burns and sores that people used to get in the past. We really are very much more able to deliver high doses of radiation with minimal complications at this point in time.
Now, you've just landed in Oxford about, 2 years ago, and you have a remit of turning the place around. What will you be doing?
Well, I've recruited. We got some large grants from Cancer Research UK, from the Medical Research Council, and also a substantial infusion of cash from the university to build a really state-of-the-art set of new laboratories out on what's called the Old Road campus, which is a campus the university is developing in Headington in Oxford. And that suite of laboratories is directly opposite a new cancer hospital that the local NHS Trust is building. So what is happening here is you're really bringing together state-of-the-art cancer treatment and state-of-the-art cancer research into a single location. And it's really going to be quite remarkable. I mean, I've been given a remit from the charities and from the universities to recruit up to 18 research groups in my field. And each of those groups will have 10 or more people in it. So by the time we're done in 4 or 5 years' time, we'll have a couple of hundred scientists working in radiation biology on this one site. And that will be by far the largest concentration of effort in the world in this field. I mean, there'll be nothing like it anywhere else.
It's very exciting.
Tremendously exciting. I mean, it's been a hell of a lot more work than I imagined when I took the job. But it is very, very exciting to see it come together. And it's also incredibly exciting to see the quality of the people that we've been able to attract to this. I mean, the young scientists that we've recruited are just stellar. The students and postdoctoral fellows who want to come and work with us are absolutely outstanding. And we're getting just a huge response. I mean, we advertised 2 graduate student positions to come and work in our field, and we got 102 applicants for the 2 positions from all around the world. I mean, so it's really quite amazing. It's amazing to see it come together.
Well, it's tremendous. Give me an idea of the sort of research nuts you're trying to crack in radiation over the next few years.
Well, we've identified 3 areas of research that we think have the potential for improving cancer treatment. Now, one is, I mentioned previously that the body has an incredible ability to repair the kind of damage that radiation causes. So we have one group of our scientists who are actually working on how radiation damages DNA and how it's repaired to see if we can interfere with that process and prevent the cancer cells repairing the damage that radiation causes. Another area that we're working on is what's called the tumor microenvironment. When a tumor starts to grow, tumors typically have a much poorer blood supply than the other organs in the body, so that the tissue within a tumor, within a cancer, is starved of blood and starved of oxygen. Now, the paradox of that is that what you'd think was a very poor environment actually makes the tumor very resistant to treatment. It makes the tumor very resistant to chemotherapy drugs and resistant to radiation. So one of the paradoxes in cancer treatment is if we could actually improve the tumor's environment, we might actually be able to treat it better. So one of my groups is working on trying to understand why the blood supply in tumors is so poor and see what we could do to actually improve that blood supply so that treatment would become more effective. It sounds counterintuitive, but we've reason to believe that it will work, and we're actually making very good progress there. We have found a number of drugs that do appear, certainly in the laboratory, to do exactly what we want them to do.
It's amazing because I heard of people doing research on the reverse, and that is you cut off the blood supply to the tumor and then it shrivels and dies.
Well, yeah, that is one of the approaches that people have tried to do in the past. The problem with that is, I mean, you can actually cause the vasculature within a tumor to collapse and the tumor will appear to go away. But at the periphery of the tumor, it's actually drawing some of its blood supply from the surrounding organs. So what you find when you use that strategy is that the periphery of the tumor actually survives and grows back very rapidly. So we are taking the counterintuitive approach and trying to improve it throughout the tumor so that drugs and radiation can penetrate fully throughout the tumor and hopefully completely eradicate it. It sounds counterintuitive, but we think that it has promise to work. The final area that we're working on is an area called signal transduction. All of the cells in the body, all the organs in the body, send and receive signals to one another all the time. And those signals tell a cell when to divide, when to stop dividing, tell an organ how large to grow and when to stop growing. Cancer has lost the ability to be controlled by these signals. It just keeps growing and refuses to respond to the normal signals that the body is sending to it, telling it should be stopping its growth. We think that that might be cancer's Achilles heel, if you like, and that we can take these abnormal signaling processes and turn them against the tumor so that it will cause the tumor to die or to commit suicide, if you like, and cease growing completely and disappear. So we've taken these three areas of research that all sound quite esoteric, but which I believe do have the potential in a relatively short time frame, 5 or 10 years, to be translated into new ways of treating cancer.
It's been such a struggle to take on cancer. You know, there was the war on cancer in the States way back and everything was thrown at it, and the bloody thing is still obviously taking its huge toll on human populations, but these sorts of really deep scientific approaches might be the way forward.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that there has been no progress. If you get cancer now, you have a considerably higher chance of surviving it than you would have had even 10 years ago. So progress has been made, but it has been incremental. And actually, there hasn't been nearly as much progress made in the UK as there should have been. I mean, there was a study just published in the last couple of weeks showing that if you're a man and if you get cancer in the United States, you have a 66% chance of still being alive 5 years later. If you're a man and you get cancer in Scotland, you have only a 40% chance of being alive 5 years later. So clearly, there's a poor distribution of optimal cancer care. Now, the Brits have recognized that, and they're making a huge investment in trying to bring cancer care up to the level of the rest of the world. And in fact, in a sense, that's why I'm here. I mean, I'm part of that investment that they're trying to make to improve cancer services.
When you say you're here, of course, you were in the United States, but you're not actually American, are you?
No, I was born in Scotland, and I went to university in Edinburgh. And I left in 1972. Now, the 1970s were not the best time to be in research in the UK. And when I got to the States, I had originally planned to go and then return. But after a short time, it became clear that actually the opportunities were much greater in the United States than they were here. And by 2005, I really thought there was no possibility that I would ever come back. I mean, I thought maybe I might retire here, but I certainly had no intention of ever moving back to work here. So it's as much of a surprise to me as to anyone else that I'm actually here at this time.
And you find Oxford slightly shocking in its traditions and the old fusty we're sitting at the moment in the, well, some people say it's the oldest college, Balliol, with absolutely gorgeous traditions. And if you go to dinner at Magdalen College, as a guest, I mean, do you know they weigh you afterwards?
I haven't had that experience. No.
Is it those sorts of things that put you off?
Oxford, in many ways, is a wonderful place to work. I mean, it is full of incredibly brilliant, very academic people, very collaborative people. You are able to attract wonderful students and postdoctoral fellows to work with you here. I do find the colleges, I mean, they're quaint, but I think, you know, a modern university is not just about undergraduate teaching. I mean, in most professions, in science, in medicine, engineering, an undergraduate degree is only the first step on a very long process of training. No one would want to be treated by a doctor who just graduated from medical school. And Oxford is very, very good at undergraduate teaching, but I believe has really neglected graduate and postgraduate education. The vast majority of the scientists that we are recruiting to work in our new research center will have no association with any of the colleges whatsoever. None of the postdoctoral fellows have, or very few of the postdoctoral fellows have any association with colleges. And even the graduate students tend to be relegated to so-called graduate colleges and not part of the great old college tradition. So I'm not an enthusiast, frankly, for the college tradition at Oxford.
No snuff and port.
Right. Snuff and port could only get you so far in this world.
I can imagine. Well, okay, well, that's very interesting. What do you think, in reflection, however, about research in medicine in general in the United States? Okay, there's plenty of money. But there are some paradoxes, like I remember being at the University of California and seeing one set of machines that you could use because it was state-funded, another set of machines with a padlock on because you could no longer use them because they were federally funded, and they were involved with stem cell research. You know, it's just some weird stuff.
I actually don't think that the environment for research in the United States is so good right now. In many ways, the environment for research in the UK is actually better and is one of the other reasons why I came here. Quite frankly, the amount of money that we have raised from the MRC and from CRUK would be inconceivable in the United States. I mean, science funding has done very poorly under the Bush administration, has fallen back. Your probability of getting a new grant or having a grant renewed in the United States has fallen to around, I think, 8% at this point in time, which is really pretty much like buying a lottery ticket. I mean, it means that you're taking many of your best minds, and instead of doing research, they're spending all the time writing grants, trying to raise the funds to do research. So I actually think that the research environment in the UK is very good at this point in time. I mean, certainly the UK is not as wealthy a country as in the United States, and none of the UK universities, even Oxford, is as wealthy as some of the great American universities. But there are some things that really are very good here, and I think the ability to get grants and to support young scientists and to do the kind of research that I'm doing is as good here as it is anywhere in the world at this point in time. It
may change. Where were you in America?
For the last 20 years, I was at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which is one of the Ivy League schools and one of the great American universities. It was certainly a wonderful place to work, and I had a very productive career there. But I'm excited now to be here. This is an adventure.
Well, as I said, we're sitting in Balliol College, Oxford, and one of the previous masters, Barry Blumberg, who got the Nobel Prize, actually, for working on the Australian antigen, you know, associated with hepatitis, and he's based in Philadelphia.
Yes, he is. He's back at the Fox Chase Cancer Center. I do know him. I don't know him personally. He's a close friend of a couple of my close friends, so I've been around him. He's certainly a great man and has been a great contributor to research in Oxford and in Philadelphia.
When it comes to radiation yourself, do you avoid Brazil nuts? Do you make sure that you carry one of those little pendants that's sensitive to all, or do you just blunder on?
I just blunder on, quite frankly. I mean, it's my chosen area of research, and if getting a little exposure to radiation is part of what it takes, it's just, for me, it's just part of the daily work.
Well, good luck with your incredible challenge. It sounds very exciting. If you were to choose one piece of music, what might it be?
Probably the four last songs. I'm extremely fond of Richard Strauss and the four last songs written in the twilight of his career, to me, are some of the most beautiful music ever written.
One of the last four songs of Richard Strauss, sung by the incomparable Janet Baker. Sir Adrian Bolt conducted the London Philharmonic Orchestra. That interview was from In Conversation, which can be heard first on ABC Radio National on Thursday evenings at 7:30. And you're with Big Ideas. I'm Robin Williams, and next week at this time, Professor Graham Clark presents the third Boyer Lecture. Here's a sample.
Back in 1967... when I set out to see if electrical stimulation of the brain could restore hearing in a deaf person, most scientists said this was not possible. Merle Lawrence, a leading American hearing scientist, said in 1964, direct stimulation of the auditory nerve fibers with resultant perception of speech is not feasible. Although the restoration of hearing function was believed to be nearly impossible, it was, together with genetic engineering, considered to be the last frontier in medicine. Scientific research had shown how numerous and complicated the nerve supply to the inner ear was, with its 10,000 nerve fibres transmitting information for speech. How could a relatively small number of electrode wires in the inner ear provide what occurs in nature?
Professor Graham Clark on the makings of a scientific miracle. That's next week at this time. I look forward to your company on Big Ideas and the third Boyer Lecture. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.